Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the end. Beautiful friend. This is the end. My only friend. The end.
The Doors definitely knew how to wrap it up. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We begin with endings. Endings are the last thing we experience, obviously, in a work of art, and the one thing that sticks in our memories. As fans of HBO's Sopranos recently discovered, not every ending neatly ties up all the loose threads and puts a bow on things. 6 seasons and 86 episodes finished with a mysterious cut to black. But in music, some of the best songs and compositions deliberately avoid clear and conclusive finales. Today, we'll try and find out why. Joining us first is Philip Kennicott, culture critic at The Washington Post. Philip, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
So what is it about endings that people are so obsessed with them, not just, you know, in our everyday lives, but in the arts as well?
Well, I think you put your finger on in your introduction, which is that it's the last thing we hear. And in a sense, it really confirms to us whether or not an artist, a composer or a writer or a filmmaker has had control of his material, if he's really kind of worked out a natural shape and tied things up. And so there is a sense that it really is the kind of last calling card an artist leaves us.
Well, now, just from the way you phrased it, you know, it seems like there is a place and a rationale for a neat and tidy ending, the kind of thing that that you've taken Hollywood to task for.
I think there's a big difference between an ending that really works, that sort of satisfies you and ties up the loose ends and maybe even gives a kind of moral judgment, you know, the classic old ending of 100 years ago or 200 years ago in a novel, and an ending that, in a sense, just feels contrived. And my concern with the Hollywood ending, and I cite as example Lord of the Rings, where you have to end every single bit of ambiguity, and they just can't stop ending the piece.
Right, so it takes an hour for the movie to go through its various endings.
Right, I think you know that film's over about 40 minutes before it actually is over.
Right. There is a school of thought that suggests that great art should mirror life itself, and life does not often have neat and tidy endings, and threads are left hanging loose.
I think it all depends on how the artist wants to define his relationship to reality. I mean, the old-fashioned one, of course, and we go back to Aristotle, is that every piece is supposed to have a beginning and a middle and ending, and there's a shape that's natural to the working out. But you're right. Of course, our lives aren't lived that way. In fact, very few of us are ever really going to know when we die and sort of experience the end of our life with closure. But, of course, we live in a society that really fetishizes closure. You know, we want to know how things are going to turn out, and even better, we kind of want there to be happy endings to everything.
Mm-hmm. If you're talking about a book, clearly people expect an ending. And of course, you know, there's just this week in the New York Times a report on Harry Potter fans obsessed with how the final book's going to end and all these spoiler alerts out on the internet and whatnot. Is it different in music where you're dealing with something that doesn't necessarily have a narrative?
I think absolutely. You know, nobody's going to say that they had the experience of a Beethoven symphony ruined for them because you told them, well, it's going to be a crescendo at the end, and then there'll be a dominant tonic cadence, and he's probably going to hit the last chord 3 or 4 times on the beat. No one's going to say, oh, you just ruined it for me. And in fact, even when we know a piece, we return to it over and over again in the course of our enjoyment of it, and the fact that we may know exactly how the piece is going to end doesn't in any sense diminish the pleasure we take in it.
And if you think of something like Wagner's Tristan, for example, he's telegraphing that ending for 5 hours before you actually get to it.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's an opera that is nothing but ending. And that, in some senses, is the problem that people who have problems with Wagner have with some of his later pieces, that it seems as if the notion of development towards conclusion is just left behind, and you're in a constant state of conclusion.
Right, we're speaking with Philip Kennicott, culture critic of The Washington Post, and that form that you just described, you know, building up to a conclusion, development to a recapitulation and a finale. I mean, those are forms that date back to the 17th, 18th centuries. But as far back as 1772, Franz Josef Haydn was already really toying with listeners' expectations of what a finale would be. I think you actually, in your article, mentioned the Farewell Symphony, right?
Right. Now, to be fair to the people who come after Haydn, he's not really playing with the harmonic series there. He's playing with the ending in a more philosophical way. But yes, you know, he diminishes the orchestra down to, I think it's just two players finally on stage, and you have, in a sense, a kind of a premonition of what, in a much more debased form, will be the kind of endless looping of a refrain in a pop song.
What you call the great cop-out of non-endings, the
right.
Fade-out. All right, let's hear a typical 18th century symphonic ending, and this is actually from Haydn's Symphony No. 95. All right. I think everybody in Haydn's day, and certainly these days, recognizes that as an ending. That's the conclusion of Haydn's Symphony No. 95. But as Philip Kennicott wrote in about Haydn's Farewell Symphony, it is radically anticlimactic. This is how that symphony ends. So it's almost fading into inaudibility there by the end, Philip. I suppose it's important to note that there was a story, there was a reason for why Haydn wrote this ending to the Farewell Symphony. It was basically a not-so-subtle hint to the prince that Haydn and the musicians all wanted to pack up and leave the summer place and get back to their wives and families and stuff back in Vienna or wherever it was that the Esterházys lived. So as the piece goes on, it's every time the music goes through a variation, two of the musicians would stand up, blow out their candles, leave the stage, right?
Right. And it's interesting, you know, the variation form, I think, is one in Haydn's day where you had a lot of some more experimental things going on. A lot of the jokes, that the false endings that Mozart plays with, you hear those, you know, particularly in the piano variations. I think that form, because it naturally doesn't have that really rigorous sonata allegro form that we expect in symphonies, first movements of symphonies in particular, because it's a more free and surface kind of form, it doesn't have that same real vector towards a conclusion built into it. And so they do have a little bit more fun with these.
Okay. We're speaking with Philip Kennicott of the Washington Post, and joining us also on the phone is Ingram Marshall, the composer who has written numerous works for orchestras, chamber groups, electronics. He joins us from his home in Hamden, Connecticut. Ingram, good to speak to you again.
Hi, John. How are you?
Okay. Now, you've said that endings are often the first thing that you'll write when you're writing a piece. Why is that?
I shouldn't have said often. I just should have said I've done it that way. It's worked out that way a few times, simply because when I compose, I often don't know how I'm going to put the pieces together. You know, I start with one thing, and it ends up being the ending. I didn't intend it that way. It's just sort of a shuffling around.
So
I don't deliberately do that.
Well, in fact, when we co-commissioned your recent piece, Orphic Memories, for the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra earlier this year, you told us during the broadcast that, you know, the piece had a kind of an ending, and, you know, it built up to a big crescendo and stuff, and that you felt that you wanted something different. You wanted so you added another section, right?
Yes, in that case, the ending was indeed the last thing I composed, and it was a bit of an afterthought. I thought I had finished the piece, and then a couple of things came up in my life, and I wanted to write a kind of a hymn of thanksgiving. And I blatantly borrowed a few notes from Beethoven's famous C sharp minor quartet that has a hymn of thanksgiving, and I constructed a canon with those notes, and it's a very quiet, fade-out kind of ending.
But a whimper rather than a bang.
Exactly. In fact, I'm definitely an advocate of the whimper, not bang endings. Yes, I'm a whimperer.
Well, Ingram, you wrote a piece some years ago called Alcatraz, which gives the last word to, of all things, foghorns. But again, as with the Haydn Farewell Symphony, it seems like there was a reason for that. I mean, you're saying something about the place that you were depicting in that composition.
Yeah, that's a very pictorial music, and originally it was done with images, slides, by a photographer friend of mine, and the last few scenes you see are indeed looking out over the bay to the city, Golden Gate Bridge, and I think the very last sound you hear in that is a foghorn, and of course there's instrumental sounds in there too, but it's a real fade-out.
This is, let's hear a little bit. This is the ending of that piece, Alcatraz, by Ingram Marshall. Something very evocative about the sound of foghorns. It ends the piece Alcatraz by composer Ingram Marshall, who's with us on the phone. Also, we're joined by Philip Kennicott, the culture critic of the Washington Post. Philip, the kind of ending that Ingram likes to write would have been unthinkable a couple of centuries ago, but it seems that, you know, at the end of the 19th century, there was kind of a rebellion against clear endings. Was that literature-driven?
Well, I think there is something in coming out of literature. Of course, you know, the 19th century is a period in which the novel often is generated as a series of daily bursts from a journalist who gets paid by the inch, practically. So there's a kind of ballooning of forms. You know, the
Dickens
novel
being the most famous example, maybe.
Right, exactly. Though, of course, Dickens' endings are usually pretty traditional, right down to the kind of moral punishment or reward for his characters. I think what I hear in that section from Ingram, and something that is happening towards the end of the 19th century, is that music also takes on a kind of painterly quality, that there's an effort to capture a sense of place or space in it. And, you know, if life is not bounded by neat, clear chapters, space, too, isn't really bounded. And I hear a kind of a wide vista in that music.
Ingram, you actually have done other pieces that attempt to evoke a place, maybe not a specific one, but certainly that attempt to create a kind of sonic landscape.
Indeed. I mean, I often my music has to do with images, very clear images of landscapes or places. I mean, Alcatraz is just one example, but it's not always clear what they are, but in an abstract kind of way. And I think painterly is a good word for a lot of my music, especially the way I end pieces. And, you know, by the way, a fade-out is not a cop-out necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
It can be if you really don't have any, if the fade is simply the same thing over and over again, just slowly getting quiet down to nothing, that is a kind of a fade-up, a cop-out. But I think if you fade out and there's still something happening in the music, some kind of development, but it just kind of slowly disappears, I think that can be much more interesting.
And I think that's true. When I talk about cop-out, I mean really the kind of endless repeating of just the refrain in a pop song. But, you know, of course, you know, even that sort of repetition can be very musically interesting if we think of something like Bolero, which I guess we might call a fade-up rather than a fade-out.
What about Hey Jude, where it's the same na-na-nas over and over again, but even as it's fading, you're getting different sort of, you know, yelling and screaming, basically, from the various Beatles as the thing continues its fade.
Sure, yeah, and I think that works, too. I mean, there is something very hypnotic about that kind of ending.
All right, Ingram, another of your pieces is called Kingdom Come, a large work that features, you know, tape sounds, as you often employ in your pieces. Going back to what you were talking about before, about, you know, having a sense of place in a lot of the music. The ending of Kingdom Come, tell us what's happening here.
Well, it's one of those in my beginning is my end and vice versa type of situations.
In my beginning is my end is a famous, 14th century piece of
music? Well, yes, it is, and also the T.S. Eliot famously quoted those lines, or maybe he thought he made them up, I don't know. and it's actually one of my piano quartets has that as a subtitle. But what I mean in this case was that the opening section of Kingdom Come, there's two openings, a first section and a second section, they actually are combined at the end of the piece, so you hear them simultaneously. But that's not the end. What happens then is like the very ending is this real fade down where you begin to hear snippets of things that had come before in the piece. They're kind of like memory bits, like little bites of memory. And that just very slowly dissolves down to nothing. You just hear a bass drum and the piano and these strange disembodied voices. But you've heard them before. So it's the kind of ending where you're kind of reminding the listener what had happened.
The non-cop-out fade-out ending. Let's hear a little bit from Ingram Marshall's Kingdom Come. Just these wisps of voices on tape, a couple of deep notes on the keyboard, you know, things that are almost echoes of, well, I guess they are literally, Ingram, echoes of things that you've used earlier in the piece.
We didn't hear the loud section that came before, which was the combination of those two opening sections, but that's all right, because I think the contrast is actually, for an ending to work that's going to be very quiet, I think it has to work in the context of something that's come before it that probably was larger in its scope.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there are exceptions to that rule.
We're speaking with composer Ingram Marshall and with Philip Kennicott, the culture critic at the Washington Post. And Philip, we started talking about how towards the end of the 19th century you began to see, especially in music but in literature as well, a different approach to endings. In the early 20th century, you have Sibelius with one of the most ambiguous endings of a major symphony ever, his Symphony No. 5. What kind of trend, I mean, what kind of impression do you think Sibelius was going for?
Well, you know, he was one, I think, to play with music kind of in a philosophical way rather than, you know, at the level of harmony or structure as other composers at the time. And I really don't know the answer to that. I still find that ending shocking every time I hear it. If I didn't know that he was a pretty sober guy, you would tend to think that maybe he was playing a joke on you.
He wasn't always sober.
He wasn't always sober, I'm afraid. Yeah, Ingram's right.
I think Benjamin Britten once accused him in the Symphony No. 6 of having been drunk when he wrote a particular passage.
Well, look, let's just compare and contrast a classic symphonic ending. In fact, it is Beethoven's Fifth, which ends with 29 bars of blasting fortissimo C major chords, and then the Sibelius conclusion. There's Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, the finale, these very rhythmic chords, but now listen to the rhythmic chords at the end of Sibelius's Symphony No. 5. That is still one of the strangest endings in all of classical music, the Symphony No. 5 by Sibelius. Ingram Marshall, you're a big Sibelius fan. You've quoted from him. You've even sampled his music in your own work. What do you think of his... I mean, he was not a particularly avant-garde guy. What was
Have you ever heard the original version of that symphony before he did that ending?
Right.
Quite different. And, you know, to me, what makes that ending tricky is the rhythm, not so much the chords, because it's a fairly traditional harmonic progression. It's not knowing, you never know exactly where those chords are going to come in unless you have a score in front of you.
Yeah.
But like, look at the Seventh Symphony, which you probably don't have to play, but it's also a bit of a surprise, but very different because it's all clustered together, and it's really a harmonic kind of ambiguity, not a rhythmic one, but it's another for me, a kind of a surprise ending.
Philip, we were talking before about fade-outs, and in the 1960s, you know, that really started to gain a lot of traction, especially in the world of pop music. How much of a role did technology play in sort of making it possible for fade-outs and other sorts of endings like that?
Well, certainly if you have a little knob and you can just turn it and then the music's over with, that makes it a very easy way to end a piece of music. Certainly easier than, for instance, trying to figure out a much more kind of forthright conclusion on the composer's part.
So when you're out of ideas, just hit that knob.
That's right.
Or just stop.
Just stop, yeah.
Because that's also a kind of a new way of ending a piece. And I think we can thank Steve Reich for that to some degree. I won't tell you specifically what pieces, but a number of his pieces just end. They're just rolling along and suddenly stop.
Well, didn't the Beatles do that? Didn't John Lennon famously just cut the tape at one point?
Oh, maybe so. I don't know. What are you talking about?
It's I Want You, She's So Heavy.
Oh.
I think what you're seeing also is that as... you know, as the length of a piece it becomes much more flexible, where you put the ending is a harder question, and sometimes people can't really answer that. You might think of a piece that's subtitled ASAP, which is not as soon as possible but as slow as possible, by John Cage. That's supposed to go on for, I think, 630-some years. Now, the ending of that piece, I suspect, is going to be anticlimactic.
Isn't that being performed someplace as we speak?
I think there's a town in Germany that's doing it.
For 632 years. Well, good luck to them. We're going to end with one of the granddaddy of all endings, the coda to Layla by Derek and the Dominoes. Let me thank the two of you, Philip Kennicott, culture critic at the Washington Post, and Ingram Marshall, composer, for joining us this afternoon.
Is this the end, John?
This in the beginning is your end, yes. This is the end for now.
Great talking.
All right, Ingram, thanks very much. Philip, thank you for being with us, too.
Thanks.
This is Soundcheck.